We'll hear argument now in the case of Hader against Two Rivers. Mr. Wood. You should be suing your fellow members of the bar for non-support for their apparent lack of interest in your argument.
I seem to have an effective clearing courthouse in Milwaukee, and I see that it's following me here. If it pleases the court, my name is Everett Wood, and I'm with the firm of Davis & Kielfeld in Milwaukee. We're here today on the matter of Hader versus the City of Two Rivers. Also present from the City of Two Rivers in the courtroom are City Administrator Greg Buckley and Fire Chief Mike Pullman. The City of Two Rivers appeals from a June 12, 2001 decision and order rendered and entered by Judge Lynn Edelman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, which granted partial summary judgment. The parties were working to frame issues for Judge Edelman and submitted the matter on cross motions for partial summary judgment on the issue of liability alone, with the idea that once a determination is made, the parties would be able to work out the damage calculations accordingly. Judge Edelman made in that June 12, 2001 decision three findings that the City of Two Rivers takes issue with. The first of those findings is that the city violated the Fair Labor Standards Act in using the half-time method for paying overtime to one of its employees, Mr. Christopher Hader, primarily because of a lack of a clear mutual understanding between Mr. Hader and the City of Two Rivers concerning the basis for the pay he received. The city's position, in essence, is that such a clear mutual understanding was shown through both practice and through agreements that were reached between the city and Mr. Hader's union representatives when negotiating the terms and conditions of this particular payment for training benefits that Mr. Hader was to undertake. The city is asking the court at this point, because we're dealing with a series of undisputed facts and the application of this half-time law method to the undisputed facts, to reverse and remand. Secondly, the trial court found that the city's withholding of Mr. Heater's final pay, which was authorized by this agreement that was entered into between the union and the city, violated the FLSA. Now, the trial court made that finding despite the fact that that had not been briefed, had not been pled, and that there was an insufficient evidentiary record to make that determination that there was an FLSA finding. The city believes that that finding is not supported by the record and was procedurally wrong and therefore needs to be vacated. Lastly, the trial court found, and this is the most important issue from the City of Two Rivers standpoint, that the memorandum of agreement that was entered into between the city and the union, the trial court equated that agreement to a restrictive covenant not to compete, and on that basis found it to be unenforceable as a matter of law. Again, that issue was not pled. It was not briefed. It basically came out of the clear blue. We don't find any authority for the position that Judge Edelman came up with in any jurisdiction, and the city believes that the ruling is procedurally deficient and simply substantively wrong as a matter of law. The particular significance, Your Honors, and why this is so important, this third and final issue, is that we're dealing with a reimbursement of training benefits agreement that is not unique to the City of Two Rivers. These sorts of repayment for retraining benefits does have significant application to other municipalities who may be put in a poor position because of the precedential nature of the trial court's decision.
not clear why you then want to boost the level.
Well, this does appear because of the significance of the FLSA ramification
Are there any cases of similar kind pending in state court dealing with the recapture of educational expenses?
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Dealing with that issue a bit further, the recovery and the reimbursement idea, the trial court relied primarily on the Presbyterian Church for the shorthand use of this case in going outside.
They didn't certify them to the Supreme Court of Michigan. Sorry, last case.
The trial court relied on that case in order to say that it could go beyond the scope of what had been briefed to render a decision on basically sua sponte merit. But in the Presbyterian Church case, there was at least a pleading which gave the court that basis. The complaint in that particular case contained an allegation that the trial court then grabbed onto and rendered a summary judgment decision on, even though none of the parties had briefed that matter. In this instance, the pleadings do not even contain the allegations upon which the court...
I don't understand what pleadings have to do with cases by the time they get to the summary judgment stage.
It seems that at least in the Presbyterian...
Rule 54C says the prevailing party gets the relief to which he's legally entitled, whether it's in the pleadings or not.
In this instance, Your Honor, the pleadings were referring specifically to state law violations in relation to this reimbursement, in relation to the last and final withholding, but an FLSA violation in relation to the ability to recover in any instance. And that is the way we approached it from a briefing standpoint, and having done so and then having the decision be completely unrelated to anything that was briefed seems to have precluded the City of Two Rivers from the opportunity to address the issue on those merits.
From the opportunity of addressing it here. I mean, here you are, you've had your opportunity to file a brief. It would make no sense to remand it to the district court so you could brief it in the district court in order to bring it back up here, where we could decide it on the basis of the briefs already filed.
We believe
the
that
legal point.
We believe that reversal is called for on a substantive basis, Judge.
Right, on
here's
a substantive basis. But there's no point in having more proceedings in the district court on a wholly legal issue that's already been fully briefed in the Court of Appeals.
Let me address the substantive basis then more fully. The case that we are relying upon, as cited in our briefing, was the Howell decision. It's a Wisconsin decision which addressed, in this particular instance, repayment of retraining benefits in Howell for an apprentice electrician who had a provision in his contract which said if he did not go to work for this particular company that was paying for him to receive his training, that he would then have to repay those benefits. In this instance, we're not exactly in the same sort of situation, but we do have some similarities here to Howell. One is reimbursement in this matter was not dependent upon Mr. Heater going to work for some other entity. This is not a situation much like in the sales area where you typically run into non-competes where there's some confidential information or some reason why an employer would not want somebody to go to work for someone else because of the internal workings. Here, the issue was the training benefits provided.
There's obviously a shortage of Wisconsin law dealing with this form of recapturing training costs. There's, of course, another traditional way of bearing training costs, and that's to have the employee get the training at his own expense.
Correct.
A way of bearing training costs that all of us lawyers are well aware of. Right, you get the training at your expense before you go to work for a law firm. Now, has Wisconsin discussed that method? I mean, suppose the law firm says, and if you work for us for 3 years, we'll give you the cost of your law school tuition as a bonus.
I am not aware of the reverse being decided in a case in Wisconsin at all.
And these are just two sides of the same coin, either. Right? One way is to say, you pay out of your own pocket. If you work for us for X years, we'll repay you. The other way is to say, we'll pay for it up front. If you don't work for us for more than X years, you repay us. So I'm interested in whether the state court has dealt with both flips of this thing.
I am unaware of that, but I could supplant with further authority, if any is found, to the court, if you so wish.
If either side finds any from the other flip, if you would file it, we'll be happy to accept it.
Very good. In this instance, that wasn't really considered, however, because the city was at a position where it had firefighters, but they weren't paramedic-trained firefighters, and they wanted to bring the whole unit up to speed to have them be paramedic-qualified. And to do that, they basically needed to do it on the fly while these people were already employed. In essence, the city doesn't care whether or not it was Mr. Heater or any other firefighter performing a certain role. What they wanted was a qualified, paramedically trained firefighter on the job. And when someone leaves before the time in which essentially the investment was made for them, now the city is in a position where it's got to go back and retrain another person to bring them up to that level.
Has there been others that left early and repaid?
There has been one other individual who left in that time period and has been repaying. There was an arrangement made for that payment to take place over a long span of time, and that has been occurring, sir. In essence, we on a substantive basis, we don't feel this is a restrictive covenant. It's asking merely for repayment of training benefits, not for any sort of triple or quadruple times that amount. It's not dependent upon Mr. Heater.
Yeah, I understand this as far as where does the repayment requirement come from? What language?
It is found in a memorandum of agreement that was entered into before this training program began, that was entered into between the city and the union on behalf of all the employees.
There was no collective bargaining agreement.
A portion in the CBA that would otherwise be applicable, but this specific MOA replaces the CBA's provisions and was specific to this paramedic retraining. In fact, it cut a better deal for the employees that it shortened the time period that was otherwise in the CBA's repayment provisions. There is a public policy that's also stated here that is kind of laying beneath the surface, and that if the trial court's conclusions are eventually accepted, there is a disincentive to smaller municipalities, such as Two Rivers, to train people like this. Once they receive the higher skills, they can move on to other larger fire departments and use the skills that they've now received in other ways. And without the reimbursement provision, a smaller municipality, such as Two Rivers, are caught in a position where they may be providing benefit to these people without seeing the results in the end. And I see my time is up before rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Wood. Mr. Olson.
Good morning, judges. I'd like to just address a couple of the points, at least initially, which Mr. Wood just raised. Judge Easterbrook, in response to your question, I'm unaware of any Wisconsin cases that have dealt with stay with us and we'll pay you back. However, that is a very, very common practice, which I would see no contractual reason. I happen to teach a business law class on occasion. Many of my students are there on employer plans.
The district court's view is that this, we pay you back, the employee must pay the employer back, is equivalent to a three-year no-compete clause because it makes it financially imprudent for someone to leave before 3 years are up. But the deal I just specified, come to work for us, bear your own employment costs, and after 3 years we'll give you a bonus equal, say, to the cost of your legal education or your paramedic education, is economically absolutely identical. And if the state is not going to treat the bonus clause, you pay up front, we give you a bonus, as equivalent to a restrictive covenant, I don't see why it would treat the first approach as equivalent to a restrictive covenant. It's economically identical. And of course, there's a third way to do it. The employer could say to the employee, you have to bear the cost, and we'll make you a loan. And the loan can then be retired or forgiven or, right, there are all sorts of possibilities. And we observe all of these different arrangements in the world. And these are all things that are done. School districts, for example, sometimes require teachers to get master's degrees, require the teachers to bear the cost, but also extend credit. And I'd be very surprised if state courts would treat these economically similar, if not identical, arrangements in a completely different way.
I will take a look, and if I can find something, Your Honor, I will supply it. One other thing I would like to point out, Mr. Wood, now maybe it's just a matter of a little bit of confusion with your question referred to this memorandum of agreement being in effect prior to the paramedic training program began. There was an old memorandum of agreement which had nothing to do with paying back any wages, any paramedic premiums, any overtime costs. That was simply a cost that was borne by the employer. However, if the employee left within 3 years of their date of hire, which Mr. Heater had exceeded by many years by the time this happened, then he had to pay back out-of-pocket costs, books and tuition. That was it. And if that was the only issue that was going on in this case, this would never have been a lawsuit back in Manitowoc Circuit Court to begin with before it was removed. The problem was the second memorandum of agreement was signed when Mr. Heater was 50% of the way through this paramedic program. He's already halfway into it.
You said now, it was a better deal this time. Is that not true?
That is not definitely not true.
So the previous provision, the earlier CBA or MOA or whatever it was that was in place, was more generous than this one?
That's correct. The old agreement, which was re-signed 4 days before Mr. Heater hit his third anniversary at the Two Rivers Fire Department, said that during the first 3 years of your employment, you have to pay back any out-of-pocket training costs we have, tuition and books, if you leave before the 3 years. That was re-signed on January 20th of 97. Chronology is really critical in this case. January 24th of 97, Chris Heater hit his third anniversary. He's free and clear. No more payback agreement. No more memorandum. February of 97, Chris Heater is required to begin paramedic training. The city of Two Rivers mandated. He had no choice. If he didn't take it, he had no job. Interestingly enough, the overtime that he was paid for wasn't actually paid until the following September because he wasn't going to get paid overtime unless he successfully completed. That's an FLSA violation. That's not an issue here. I'm only bringing it up as background information. That's not involved at all. So May 30th of 1997, Chris Heater is halfway through. He has accrued this overtime, which he hasn't been paid for yet, but they promise they're going to pay him in September if he completes successfully. Now, bingo, the new agreement is signed, and that new agreement is found on the record at 27. I can give you a supplemental site, too, but I'm sure the court has it. That agreement suddenly comes up with a new provision which says, listen, from 3 years of the commencement of your paramedic training, now for Chris Heater, that's February of 97, even though the month earlier the prior clause no longer applies to him. But for 3 years from the commencement, you have to pay back not only tuition and books, but all the overtime we're going to pay you for going, which also is required by the Fair Labor Standards Act to be paid. That's the rub. Now he's got this Hobson's choice. It's May 30th. He's got to keep going or he loses his job.
I don't see why the Fair Labor Standards Act requires payment of overtime. If a school district says to a teacher, you need to get the master's degree before the end of your third year of employment here, does the school district have to pay the teacher for all the time he or she spends pursuing a master's degree?
Point is well taken, Judge Easterbrook. In this case, the union contract agreement said, however, that you're going to be required and we're going to pay you overtime. And once it's a requirement of the employer and the Fair Labor Standards Act, which kicks in and says if you're going to make him go and you're going to make him do it on overtime, then you have to pay him. So this is different than an educational requirement or a CLE requirement for lawyers or something of that sort.
So it's not the FLSA by itself. It's the fact that the union imposed or agreed upon a provision for overtime that then brought in the FLSA. Is that the way I understand it?
In part, that is correct, Judge Mannion. The only other flipper, which is not in the briefs because I didn't expect it to come up, there is a provision.
Well, unexpected things in this case.
That's true. There is a provision in, I want to say it's 29 CFR 553 somewhere, and I can't give you the exact site. It's months since I've read it, which does indicate that for mandatory training, the overtime rules apply for non-exempt employees. Okay. Now, another issue with teachers is, although I've never had a teacher FLSA case, I'm going to guess they're exempt. I think they're going to be professional or administrative. They would probably not management. So once you're exempt from the overtime requirements of the FLSA because you're an exempt employee, then it's who cares what, as long as the only single requirement then for that exempt employee is going to be that they have to get paid more in minimum wage. There is no overtime requirement any longer.
In order to keep his job, he has to take this training.
He does.
But he also has to pay for it if he leaves early.
If he leaves prior to 3 years before the date he started taking the training. That was the big change.
Did that second, or the last memorandum of understanding, whatever.
Correct.
Whatever what, contemplate people who were midstream?
It did not. It was written to be retroactive. That's one of the issues. Signed on May 30th.
I understand that. So, I mean, it was written to be retroactive. Yeah,
it was. I'd love to say it wasn't, because it was another case, but it is not. It was definitely written to be retroactive. Anyway, to go on, Mr. Wood also cited to the Howell case, which I agree, that was cited by Judge Adelman at the district court as being one of the reasons that actually he rejected my argument. However, there are some significant differences from Howell in it, whether Mr. Wood simply confused the facts or whatever, but in Howell, this is an apprentice who applies for basically a union-operated, trustee-operated ERISA apprenticeship program. He has the choice of whether or not he wants to take that apprenticeship program. There are tuition costs involved with it if he goes, so he's got the choice, do I or don't I? Chris Hitter had no such choice. He was mandated to take paramedic training. One of the other bigger differences is the restrictive covenant issue, which was addressed in Milwaukee, I forget it, it's versus Howell, we've been referring to it as the Howell case, was that he wasn't barred from all employment. He wasn't even required to work as an electrician. The only time that Howell had to pay back in cash the cost of his apprenticeship is if he both worked as an electrician and worked as an electrician for a non-participating employer. And there's actually a pool of, I believe it was union employers that operated its apprenticeship program. So Howell could walk away and be a welder, no problem. He didn't have to pay it back. Howell could work as an electrician for one of these employers, no problem, didn't have to pay it back. It was solely if he went to work as an electrician. In this case, Howell actually went to work for the city of Milwaukee, which didn't participate in the program. Then he had to pay it back. But he's got that choice. The court, the Seventh Circuit, hung its hat on one of the statements was that there was no coercion, there was no surprise. May 30th of 97, when this agreement was signed after Chris was halfway through a required program, big surprise. I think one of the real critical things, we're switching back to the FLSA, which I think is a much more straightforward issue, so I'm not going to spend that much time on it. The FLSA does have, in 778.114 sub A of the CFR, actually 29 CFR, has this fluctuating rule which says that you only have to pay half-time overtime instead of full-time and a half if you meet the conditions of it. One of the critical things is Two Rivers simply doesn't meet the conditions. They're trying to push themselves into a square peg into a round hole. As the rule says, first of all, you've got to be salaried to infinity. The employee has to clearly understand your salary is going to cover whatever number of hours you want to work, and as the rule says, whether great or small. The district court found there wasn't a clear understanding, with real good reason. Fire Chief Michael Pullman testified, a Two Rivers fireman, is salaried for 2,912 hours a year, which happens to be 56, the average hour work week, times 52 weeks. Comes out to 2,912. Two Rivers union contract has a bunch of contractual overtime rates. Additionally, administrative assistant Debbie Tim, when she was deposed, testified, a Two Rivers firefighter is salaried for 216 hours every pay period. We can dig into semantics. Nobody has any dispute that the pay period that they're using or the work period is correct. That's not an issue here. 216 is where the time and a half provision kicks in, unless you're able to slide in under this fluctuating rule, at which point it would be halftime. But the very critical distinction between the fluctuating rule and between the regular rules, which say time and a half, in this case over 216, is that because your salary is designed to compensate you for the actual number of hours that you really work in that work period, whatever they may be, that means the hourly rate is going to be different every work period. If you work in 260 hours, your hourly rate is going to be less than if you work in 216 hours. And therefore, because your hourly rate changed, your halftime rate changed. That never happened here. Whether Chris Hedder worked 204 hours, whether you worked 261.5 hours. If hourly rate was always, or half hourly rate, which the parties have agreed was calculated correctly, was always $5.58. There are five primary cases which have been cited by both sides. Flood, Condo, which was a Seventh Circuit case, Monahan, Bailey, and Griffin. I think Bailey only came up in Turber's reply brief. All five of those cases mentioned, generally as a side note because it wasn't an issue, that the employee's hourly rate is always fluctuating when they approved the use of the fluctuating rule. When Two Rivers didn't...
The hourly rate is fluctuating or the time he actually works is fluctuating?
They both have to fluctuate correspondingly.
But if he works 216 or less, if you were, then he gets paid a flat salary, doesn't he?
It's a little more complicated, but we have no dispute below 216 if that would be sufficient. He's got to get paid overtime over 204. But because he is currently salaried through 216, we agree with Two Rivers. They only have to pay him halftime from 204 to 216.
Between 4 and 16, and then
right.
Over 16 is time and a half.
That's our position because they aren't able to use the fluctuating rule because they don't meet the facts. Their position is they do meet the fluctuating rule's facts, so therefore they only have to pay halftime because they claim his salary goes to infinity. If he works 300 hours in a week, he only gets halftime. But the problem is if you take his salary and divide it out by the number of hours in the work...
300 hours in a week.
I'm sorry?
There aren't 300 hours in a week. It's not possible to work 300 hours in a week, although I will swear some lawyers have billed 300 hours in a week.
My apologies, Your Honor. I meant work period, which in this case is a 27-day work period. They're kind of an interchangeable term when you're dealing with firefighters. The problem is when you go up to 300 hours in a work period, then you're dividing that 300 by the amount of his salary, and it comes out to be a smaller amount per hour. Therefore, the halftime component is going to be smaller if you work 300 hours in a work period than if you work 250 or you work 216. But Two Rivers never changed. It was always 558. And that's a classic sign, as in the Department of Labor's administrative letter ruling of 1986, interestingly done under a Republican administration, which says that when you have that scenario, it's not fluctuating, you got to pay time and a half when you clear that 216 hump.
Mr. Olson, what's the size of this department?
Approximately. I'm going to guess probably on the order of 25 to 30 firefighters. I would certainly default to Mr. Wood if I'm off.
If you're wrong, I'm sure.
As to the grounds not pled, Judge, I agree with you that, I mean, it's here to send it back to Judge Edelman or a different judge to decide the same thing and come back up. And interestingly, we have raised the FALSA as a reason that withholding should not have occurred. And specifically, I direct the court, the district court's briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Wood?
Just very briefly, Your Honor. First and foremost, Two Rivers Fire Department is 13 personnel. That is, it's a significantly smaller amount here. It is a smaller entity. As to the agreement and this memorandum of agreement versus the collective bargaining agreement and how they fit together, the city's position is that this was a better deal for the firefighters than the old collective bargaining agreement, not from a standpoint of time, but certainly the union and the city both understood that these were going to be significant benefits to the firefighters to be able to have the paramedic training. It would increase their hourly rate significantly by approximately, if I'm not mistaken, around the $3 per hour rate higher than what they had been making before. And that therefore, plus with the training skills, the union and the city together, before this program ever was implemented, thought this was a great idea, that we should have mandatory paramedic training. And there are memorandum of agreements and minute meetings that speak to the issue of the negotiations that were taking place between the city and the union representatives regarding this retraining program before they ever began. There's a minutes from a December a meeting of the firefighters union in which there was a unanimous 13-0 vote that the union representative should have continued authority to negotiate benefits in relation to this retraining. So that this isn't some sort of a surprise when the memorandum of agreement is finally completed legally in May the following year, some 6 months later, is, I would submit, not entirely correct. Originally, the city and the union had it thought that they could donate some of that time. In other words, that the base salary would cover not only any hours that were already being worked, but also this training time. That was the initial conception between the union and the city. And only when they went to legal counsel to start drafting the agreement up did somebody say, hey, what about the FLSA? And then they discovered you got to pay FLSA on that donated time. Once that concept was integrated, then the city agreed and committed an even better deal to the union that it would pay FLSA overtime, even after that had already been approved at the city council level for a donation of that extra time. So the city had to pay out more than what it initially agreed to, and this was a better deal in its final form as the memorandum of agreement in May than it had been agreed to back in December.
No good turn goes unpunished.
In this
Indeed.
Instance... Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wood.
Thank you, Your Honor.